The question was asked last week about Baruch Shein Kvod Malchus Sod Olam Moed, and why is it that we recite it on Yom Kippur aloud? So I in Hilchos Yom HaKippurim, so the Shulchan Aruch mentions that maybe in Mechaber Ramah says that we say Baruch Shein Kvod Malchus Sod out loud. And the reason, as I had surmised last week, had something to do with the fact that we are like the angels. So apparently there is a medrash. So now I can't even remember which Achron, the Shari Tshuva, I think, quoted. And there's a medrash that says that actually Baruch Shein Kvod Malchus Sod Olam Moed is the secret that the angels have. And we don't want to make the angels upset or angry by using their phrase. So that's why we do it quietly. However, on Yom Kippur, when we are Doma L'Malachim, so then we can actually use the phrase and say it out loud. Whichever one of the Achronim I saw quoted in either the Shari Tshuva or the Mishnah Berurah points out what I thought last week, that this Medrash really is in conflict with the Medrash that the Rif quoted. In other words, there are really two different traditions, if we can call it, as to the origin of Baruch Shein Kvod Malchus Sod Olam Moed. In one Midrashic tradition, which the Gemara in Pesachim has, that the Rif quotes here, is Baruch Shem is what Yaakov said, but Moshe didn't say it, so we say it quietly. Doesn't explain why we said it loud on Yom Kippur. And the other Medrash simply says that it has nothing to do with that. It's the secret code of the angels. So while we steal it and imitate them, we don't want to get them upset, so we do it quietly, except for on Yom Kippur when we are similar to angels. Okay. So anyway, we left off last week at the bottom, last line on Daf Tes Vav Amud Beis. We had just finished the discussion of being medakdek the Osios Kriya Shema, and now we have another statement here. Just because previously we had Rabbi Chama, Rabbi Hanina quoting an agadic statement, I believe somewhere earlier. So now the Gemara quotes the following statement. Ba'ama Rabbi Chama b'Rabbi Chanina lama nismachu oholim l'necholim. Why are oholim, tents, next to necholim, next to streams? D'chsiv ki necholim nitayu ki ganos alei nahar, ka aholim nata Hashem, ka arazim alei mayim. Now, before we talk about what the Gemara's answer or Rabbi Chama Rabbi Hanina's explanation, agadic explanation as to what the juxtaposition of tents and streams are, first you have to figure out what he means by ahalim. Ahalim means tents. Where do you see ahalim? So if you look in this pasuk, the Rashi says, "Kin halim nitayu kiganos alei nahar, ka ahalim nata Hashem." So Rashi says that ahalim l'nechalim. He just writes, "Kin halim nitayu ka ahalim nata Hashem." But most of the other Rishonim disagree with Rashi because they point out that the word aholim doesn't mean tents. Ohalim means tents. Ohal is the singular, cholam and a segol. And when you make it plural, it's typically kamatz, chataf, kamatz, and aholim. The aholim in this particular pasuk are a kind of spice. Unklus translates, I think, busmin, like besamin. And all the Rishonim, Tosus points that, and all the other Rishonim pointed out, this is not the ohalim that are being compared to the mechalim. Rather, you have to go back, I don't know, a verse or two, where Bilam says, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov mishkanosecha Yisrael kinichalim nitayu. So Bilam almost has explicitly compared ohalecha, that means tents, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov, to the nechalim, to the streams. So the Gemara now, okay, so that's just what was the question, or what was the darshan's question? So now the Gemara says, lomar lecha, just as rivers, streams, are bring a person from a state of tuma into a state of tara, so too ohalim, which refers to the ohal of Torah, as a very famous drash of Chazal, zos haTorah adam ki amus ba'ohel. Ohel is supposed to be Torah is only miskayim on misha may misatz mala, someone who really is dedicated, extremely dedicated. So it has to be zos haTorah adam ki amus ba'ohel. You want to be successful in Torah, you have to, in effect, die in the ohel. So just as rivers, streams, raise a person from tumah, impurity, to purity, so two tents raise a person from kav chova to kav sechos, from being liable to being liable to punishment to being to be judged, to be exonerated. That can either be for one of two reasons, either because the zechus of Torah, the mitzvah, Or perhaps even more likely, a person who is learned and steeped in Torah is more, hopefully, more likely or certainly in a position to make more informed decisions in accordance with Torah values. One very interesting side thing that I know that none of the Rishon I'm going to comment on, but I do feel it actually necessary, at least to observe. It's an interesting statement that Nechalim are Malinus Adam Mituma Latara. A Nachal is a stream or a river. The implication of this statement is that if a person is Tamei and they wish to become Tahor, they may go into the river and it will purify them, which is a very fascinating assertion, because this question is a major machlokas in the Gemara and it's a major machlokas in the Shulchan Aruch as to whether or not a person who needs to go to the mikveh, or for that matter, if you wanted to immerse kelim, if you wanted to immerse vessels for tfilas kelim purposes, or I mean, we only do it today when we buy new kelim, you know, they were owned by a non-Jew, but once upon a time, they did it for Tumah V'Tahara purposes. The implication of the Gemara is that a nachal, a river, a stream, can be used as a mikveh, which is a very, very big chiddush. Why is it such a novel point? What is so unusual about it? So the reason there's a dispute about whether or not you can use a river for immersion, for tevilah, centers around the following first basic halachic principle and then a question of reality. The halachic principle is that there are two kinds of bodies of water that can be metaher a person. One is called a mikveh, and one is called a mayan. Not yesterday, but a week ago on Shabbos, we read, you know, ach mayan, ach mikveh. I can't get the pasuk anymore. Ach mayan uvar umikveh mayim hiyeh tahor. So, what is the difference between a mayan and a mikveh? A mikveh implies that the waters have gathered together, like yikavu hamayim. A mayan is a flowing spring. So the difference between a mayan and a mikveh in terms of halachic considerations is that for a mikveh to purify a person or a kli or a vessel, the mikveh has to be what's called eshboren, still water. I have no idea what the etymology of that word is, but it's a word that occurs frequently in rabbinic literature. We talk about eshboren versus zochalin. Zochalin means either trickling or flowing. Eshboren means still. A mikveh, in order to work, has to be still, which is why there's a lot of money invested in mikvahs today, where they have sensor systems to make sure there's no leak in the mikvah, right? There are all sorts of things to test that the mikvah level, the water is not somehow declining on its own because there's an unnoticed crack. Because if there's a crack in the mikvah and the water is very slowly flowing out, it may have the status of what's called zochalin. And zochalin, water that's flowing, if it is not spring water, cannot be mitaher, a person, or a kli. So that's why they try to be very, very careful with our mikvahs, that to make sure that no water is actually leaking out. A spring water means water that comes out of the ground and is still connected basically to its source. It has the status of what's called a ma'ayon. And a ma'ayon can purify a person or a vessel even if it's flowing. It doesn't. If the spring sort of bubbles up in pools, it's fine. And if it's flowing, it's fine. But a mikveh cannot be metahir a person or a thing or a kli unless it is still. Now, so that's the basic halachic principle. It's laid out in great detail, or at least in some detail, in the first parak of Maseches Mikvos towards the end of the parak. Now, incidentally, it's just worth adding one other note. There is another level above a ma'ayan, which is called mayim chayim. Mayim Chayim, which we saw in last week's Parsha a number of times, which is necessary for purifying Mitzora. It's necessary for a Zav, and it will be necessary in Parshas Chukas for using the ashes of the red heifer of the Paraduma in order to purify someone. Mayim Chayim has to be Mei Mayon, but it also has to be good water. If the water is extremely salty or sulfuric, it's still considered a ma'ayan, and you can go to the mikveh in it, unless you are a zav, a man who's a zav, a mitzora. Well, it doesn't go to the mikveh in it, but the kohen needs it for the purification ritual and for the kiddush efer chatas, in order to make the sprinkling waters for the paraduma. So there's mayim chayim, which is a spring, and it's good water. Then there's just a regular ma'ayan, which can purify even when it's flowing. And a mikveh, which is still water, that could be any water that's good for a mikveh, but it's not, it could be rainwater, It could be runoff, and that would be out of the status of mikvah.
Rabbi, now,
what's the question with Isaac?
Yeah, Mayim Chaim, does that have any effect on mikvah-o that we use today? Is it relevant in any way? No.
I believe it's irrelevant.
Okay.
Certainly in our structures that we call mikvahs. And I would say it's irrelevant today anyway, because we don't have Tum Vatara, so we don't have Mitzora, we don't have a Zav for all intents and purposes, and we don't have Paraduma. So for really almost as best as I can recall, I think there's the only three dinim. There is a strange Rashi in Shabbos to maybe, or quotes a sheet that thinks that maybe a Zava requires it, but Rishonim will reject that. Now, one question is, what is a river? Where does the river's water come from? So the Gemara in Shabbos has a machlokas between, it would seem, Rav and Shmuel, what the primary source for the river water is. Whether or not it's rainwater and runoff, or whether it's mikipe misperech, the keif is the rock. Now, obviously, all spring water, pretty much, is rainwater that percolates through the ground. I don't know if Chazal fully grasped that point, but from a halachic perspective, what we'd say is that even though rainwater is not good to be a mayan, once the rainwater gets into the ground, into the aquifer, into the source of the springs, now it's mayan. And if it comes out of the ground and it's flowing, that is considered meimayon, and you can immerse in it even though it's actually flowing, it's not still. The question is, what really are our rivers? And the Shmuel himself may draw a distinction between during the spring versus at the end of the summer. During the spring, the assumption is that a majority of the rain, of the water in the river, may be snow melt and runoff from rain, in which case there may be a problem using it as a mikvah. At the end of the summer, talking about in Israel here, where you haven't had rain in however long, at that point the assumption is that the river might be really more spring water that came out of the ground and is still feeding the river. In Shulchan Aruch, the issue, they don't take really think like it's a great idea. The Mechaber, I think, doesn't allow the use of a river. The Ramo, I think, doesn't like it, but he acknowledges that seems to have been the minhag. In many places, they use rivers as mikvaos. But this is an issue that comes up actually all the time. We have an issue in the camp that I usually visit for a couple of weeks here in Camp Stone. There's a lake, but the lake has an outflow. In other words, it's not the end of where all the water pools. And therefore, since most of the water in the lake is either filled by man-filled or rain runoff, so it's not good as a mikveh because of the outflow. It's effectively more like a river, but we know exactly where the source of the water is. So it's kind of interesting that the Gemara here, again, it's an Agada, says that just as Nechalim are Malin as Adam Ituma Latara, so to Alim. So that's really a question whether a Nachal can purify a person. But obviously, depending upon the context, some streams or rivers may clearly be really sourced from a spring, in which case it's not a problem if it's flowing. Whereas in a situation where you can determine that it's snow melt and rain and runoff from the rain, then in fact it would not be good as a mikvah.
Rabbi Weider, what's the status of ocean?
So the ocean is a machlokas in the Mishnah. Everybody agrees that you can use the ocean, but I think it's a machlokas whether or not it's a mikveh, a mayan. I forget. There are three opinions in the Tanaim. But an ocean certainly I'm pretty sure it's not Mayim Chayim because it's salt water. I don't know whether how much of enough. I think I know what the difference would be. But for all intents and purposes, you can immerse yourself and you can immerse your kalim in the ocean. The more interesting question, which I assume is not a problem, I've had actually unfortunately used for this during the pandemic, is the Hudson River. I don't mean the Hudson River when you go upstate New York. I mean the Hudson River, go from your apartment on the Upper East Side and, head due west across Manhattan and jump into the Hudson River. The Hudson River there is not a river. It's a tidal estuary. Sometimes it flows in, sometimes it flows out. I assume that that's considered part of the ocean. I assume that if you go north to, the Bear Mountain Bridge or something like that, at that point, it's already a river. And then it would be subject to this particular question. I had a minor use for this because when the Kelim Mikvah was closed, presented problems, obviously, for Tfilas Kalim. And what do you do? And the answer is, if you know how to find yourself a good spot in the Hudson River, so then you have a place to Tovel Kalim.
But the Dead Sea would, because it has too many chemicals, would definitely not be qualified as a mikveh.
The what?
The Dead Sea, the Yam HaMelech.
I don't think it would. Well, I don't know why it wouldn't qualify as a mikveh.
Because it's very salty and has lots of chemicals.
So that it's not Mayim Chaim. I agree, but it still should count. And I'm pretty sure that the Dead Sea has no outflow since it's the lowest place on Earth. So the Dead Sea certainly qualifies as Eshboren. I don't think it's discussed in Chazal as far as I'm pretty sure it's not, at least in Mishnah Mikvahs, but I could be wrong. I don't recall it ever being discussed. They talk about the Yam HaGadol, whether that's a mikveh mayim and so on. But I don't recall any discussion about the Yam HaMelach, but I don't see why it shouldn't be good at least as a mikveh. Good luck in getting, if you're talking about yourself, good luck in immersing yourself completely under the water in one shot. But that's a mechanical problem or pragmatic problem, not a conceptual problem, as far as I know. Okay, fine. So you would never think such a seemingly innocent agada could be so loaded, but it actually is loaded. I haven't taught or learned mikvahs in a while, so I don't remember if anybody bothers to cite this agada, that there has to, you know, a support for at least Shmuel's position. But okay, fine. So now the last part of our discussion on this Mishnah. The Mishnah said, HaKori l'mafreya lo yatsa. You can't read Kriya Shema out of order. And just to remind you, both the Rambam and the Rashba said that refers to within one parsha. What was clear from, they thought, from the opening Mishnah of the Perek, which was that if you're HaYakori b'Torah v'yigiyas man ha-mikra, so that means if you're reading in the Torah, first you read Vayomer in Parsha Shlach, and then you keep moving and you read, you get to Vaschana, and then you get to Akev. So you read the Parshios out of order. You read it 3-1-2. And nonetheless, the Mishnah assumes that if you had Kavana, whatever Kavana meant, we discussed that at length, you Yotze. So when we say Akor l'mafreya lo yotze, that means that if you read within a Parsha, one of the Pesukim, out of order, you don't fulfill your obligation. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi have a kakotrin le'genana l'Rabbi Loza. Apparently, Rabbi Loza was getting married, and Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were sort of putting the chuppah together. So Amar Lahu, this is kind of, I always think it's a very funny story. The Gemara doesn't comment on this. So they're busy working. So what do you think he's doing? So I would think that he would be helping them put the chuppah together, right? It is his chuppah. But instead, he has this, you know, bright idea. He says, Amar Lahu adahachi v'hachi, while you're doing that, Ezel v'eshra mils to the Bei Midrasha. I'll pop into the Bei Midrash, see if they're going over an interesting sugyas. You know, there is a very interesting question within generally many of the laws being Adam HaChaveiro. Supposing I find your lost object. I find your lost object. So I have a mitzvah to return it to you. Now, supposing I find two objects. I was looking for my object and then I stumbled upon yours and then I find mine also. But the problem is, and the river, the volcano is coming, the lava is coming, and I can only save one of the two objects and to get out of there in time. So which object do I save? So some of you might be familiar with the very famous story, Machlokas, Rabbi Akiva and Ben Petura, two people walking in the desert and there's only one bottle of water and who gets to drink it and so on. So generally speaking, we accept Rabbi Akiva's principle, chayecha v'chayecha v'echa chayecha kodman. Your life takes precedence over someone else's when you're in sort of an equal situation. So you would think that you should in fact save your object. And, you know, that's unfortunate that his object gets lost. But someone could come along and say the following brilliant lungs. One second. There's no mitzvah of Hashava Saveda returning, taking my own object back. But your object... there is a mitzvah, so maybe I should have to save your object instead of mine, because there's no mitzvah doing mine. So that's wrong. That's wrong. The assumption, Rav Shechter quotes a Ramban, I think it's in Perek Ei L'Metzios, who says that the principle, the foundation of all mitzvahs bein adam l'chaveiro, is that it's based on v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. So it means hashavas aveda is based on v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. And because in the Haftal Recha Kamocha, you always take precedence over someone else. That's the norm. That's the expectation. The same thing is true by returning your Aveda versus taking my Aveda back. Now, the Gemara actually, you know, so that's one step. So here you might think that Rabbi Lazar said, hey, listen, it's a mitzvah for you to be not Chasa Makala, not my mitzvah. So that's that would seem to be ridiculous on the surface. But even furthermore, the Gemara actually in Bava Metzia quotes the following scenario. A person's donkey is struggling. a person's donkey is struggling with a burden, and you come along to help me. And I want to take a little break and say, listen, there's a mitzvah for you to be porek my donkey, right? But azov tazov imo, but there's no mitzvah upon me to be porek my donkey. In such a case, the Gemara says, I'm exempt from it. If you sit down and say it's your mitzvah, I'm pater from doing so. So I just thought it kind of odd. Rabbi Lazar here is they're busy, you know, sweating and putting his chuppah together. And he says, you know, while you're doing this, I'll go check out what they're saying in the base medrash. It turns out the story has a happy ending anyway.
Hello.
So now the Gemara says the following. Azal, she said, I'll go hear what they're saying in the base medrash, and I'll tell you what they say. I'll tell you. Azal ashkeche letana, the katani kame de Rabbi Yochanan. He got to the base medrash, and he heard them saying that the Tana was teaching the following in Rabbi Yochanan's presence. Kara v'ta'a v'ena yodea heichad ta'a leheichan ta'a. He makes a mistake, but he doesn't know. No clue. He started reading Kriya Shema. He has no idea how far he got. Not a clue. He can't say that for sure. I read the first three psukim, but I don't know beyond them. So the answer, the Brisa says, Yasa LaRosh. If you're not really sure, and you have no idea how much you read, and it could be three quarters of Kriya Shema, one quarter, or you even didn't even finish the first pasuk, you have to start again. Beim Perek LaPerek, if you're between a break of chapters, which could probably be, let's say, Shema, Avayim, Shema, Avayomer, so then, Yasa LaPerek Rishon. You have to go back to the, you know, you just finished a chapter, but you don't know whether you finished number one or number two or even number three. So the halacha is you assume that you go back to the first chapter break, meaning after the first one that you know you read, and you start the second one, even though you might have read it already. Then, Benksiva Leksiva, and this I think for all of us is going to ring a bell very, very strongly. Supposing you say, Uchsavta ma mezuzos be'secha v'sharecha. Now, I know that all of us have such kavana and kriya shema all the time. We never, ever, ever read it mitzvah sanashim ulumada by rote. So you find yourself, b'chas v'shalom, you said, uchsav tama mezuzos be'secha v'sharecha, and now you say, 1 second, which one am I up to? Did I just finish almost the entire second parsha and I'm almost done? Or am I just finishing v'ahavta? I am pretty sure I can only speak with absolute certainty for myself. It probably happens at least once a week. I'm sure for most of you, it's happened maybe once in a lifetime that you have this conundrum. So what do? So obviously what you do is Yachzor L'Ksiva Rishona. You go back to the first Ksiva because you're not sure. And Kriya Shema is Doraisa, Sveika Doraisa L'Chuma. The next line, I think, will resonate very deeply with all of us. Amar Le Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says to the Tana, L'Shanu Ela Shelo Pasach B'Leman Yerbu Yimeichem. That's only true that you have to go back to the first Ksiva if you didn't start the next pasuk and say leman yirbu yimeichem. However, aval pasach leman yirbu yimeichem, sirchei nakat ve'ase. If you started leman yirbu yimeichem, you should assume that your habit has led you down the correct path. Sircha means literally, a sircha can be either an adhesion or an attachment. We talk about sirchas in the lungs, in the laws of trefos. So in other words, your habit has sort of grabbed you. And if you start in Leman Yirbu Yimeichem, you can assume that you actually read the entire second parasha, finish the pasuk, and you start Vayomer Hashem Amoshe Lemor. But that too also very much resonates with me. Okay, fine. And I will remind you, I hope I haven't lowered my esteem in the eyes of anybody to suggest that I'm not always focused on my tefillah. But I'll remind you of a Yerushalmi that the Ravid quotes at the end of Hilchos Kriya Shema, that Rabbi Yochanan said, the great Tana Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, who we're just reading about now, Rabbi Yochanan said that I give thanks to my head because whenever I get to modem, it bows. So I feel like I'm not in the worst of company. Okay. So anyway.
You don't have to excuse yourself, Rabbi Weider, because there's so much in halacha about the subject of if you've forgotten, you're not sure, or you didn't know, and so on and so forth. It's obviously a very prevalent problem in the world.
I know. So the Gemara, now the Gemara says, Asav Amar Lahu, so Rav Elazar comes back to Rabbi Amin Ravasi, and he told them what he had heard. Amru Lei, Ila Lo Banu Ela Lishmo Davar Zed Dayenu. if this is the only reason we had come here to do this mitzvah, so that we'd be zocha to hear this statement of Rabbi Yochanan, the Tana, but maybe even more Rabbi Yochanan, that would have been sufficient. And if that alone, I'm sure they were happy to be making his chuppah for him, but the fact that they even got this juicy nugget of Torah, for that alone, it was worth the effort. Okay. All right. So now the Mishnah goes on to describe something which is probably less of an issue in shul for us in terms of its relevance, but more of an issue when we're davening at home, let's say during COVID or any other occasions. So the Mishnah says, "Ha'umanim korim barosh ha'ilan uvarosh ha'nidbach." If you have workers, now remember they probably started work at dawn before even they could read Kriya Shema. So they're already up in the tree, whatever they're doing, or they're up on top of the scaffolding, the nidbach. It might be literally a row of stones. It's a word that's found in Biblical Aramaic and Sefer Ezra. So they're allowed to read Kriya Shema. They don't have to come down. That which they're not allowed to do for tefillah. For tefillah, they have to come down. Why is it that they have to come down? Because the Gemara will talk about this, but tefillah requires a certain kind of kavana. So when you're high up there, and not just a kavana for understanding the words that you're reading, but actually a total focus, ideally, I understand ideally, on the enterprise of tefillah being standing in the presence of God, it's kind of hard to focus yourself on not tipping over, falling off, and things like that. So Kriya Shema, you have to understand what you're saying and know what you're doing, but it doesn't require that level of concentration. And even the Pasuk of Shema takes such a relatively short time. But for Tefillah, they have to come down. Now, a couple of things that I think emerge from the Mishnah. The first one is clearly these Poalim are not, we're not worried about Semichas Geula L'Tefillah. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shua ben Levi, who were early Amoraim, make a big deal about having Goal Yisrael being next to Tefillah. But it's also clear from their, if you say that Kol HaSomech Geula L'Tefillah is a Ben Olam Haba, it obviously means it's something that wasn't necessarily typically done. It wasn't ubiquitous, it wasn't common. For us, pretty much all of us, whenever we daven Shachris or even Mariv, we're almost always Somech Geula L'Tefillah. But for them, the Umanim were in the tree. They were in there from daybreak, from dawn. Zman Kriya Shema comes. So they're not right. It's not proper to continue working while they haven't done said Kriya Shema. So they say Kriya Shema, presumably with its brachos. But they can't daven now because you can't daven l'chatchila until after Hanetzach Hama, until after sunrise. So the Poalim may have another hour of work before they actually are going to daven. So in a perfect world, when they didn't have to be there working, they would have said Kriya Shema, 3, 4, 5 minutes before sunrise, and then they would have finished Gal Yisrael, and then they would have been Somech Geula L'Tefillah Kivasikin. However, that's not an option for them, so they say Kriya Shema earlier, and they're going to daven when the sun rises. So for davening, they have to come down. Now, what's so interesting here is that, why is it such a big deal of having the pollen come down? What are we worried about? It's an annoyance to them. So the answer is we are worried because they're working on the clock for the Baal HaBayis. Halacha in general, Hilchos Schiris Paulim in Shulchan Aruch, the laws of hiring of workers, of labor law in Halacha, is a very, very important balance between, on the one hand, respecting deeply the rights of the workers and their right to be treated with dignity and certain freedoms they have, and on the other hand, the responsibility of workers to do an honest day's work. And therefore, for the Poalim to come down from the tree, to take the time, have to come down and have to climb back up. So that time is time that's coming off the Baal HaBayis' clock. And that's not proper to do. A person, I don't know how many people in our community necessarily, I mean, some people do, some people don't work exactly on a clock. But if a person works really on the clock, it's not proper to take time off to go to Minyan. I mean, unless you're punching out and punching back in. It's proper to daven, if you have to daven mincha during a lunch break, during time that's your own. If you were in a situation where there literally were no time and you worked from before noon straight till after sunrise, we might say you're permitted to take a mincha break, but you can't take a mincha break in a minyan. You daven biyachidus because you don't take even an extra minute, which isn't truly necessary. So here, we don't want, and we'll see another example in the Gemara, we don't want to waste the time of the balabais when the balabais is paying the workers on the clock. So the it cuts, obviously it goes both ways. Halacha has a lot to say about how the balabais has to treat his workers, but it is a two-way street. So anyway, the Gemara will talk about this a little further. Now the Mishnah shifts to a topic that we've encountered before in the first parak. Chasan pater mi kriya shma laila harishona ramotzoi Shabbos im lo asa maisa. A chasan, and really what it means here is someone who is marrying a woman who is a psula, a woman who's a virgin, who is seemingly very stressed over consummating the marriage and perhaps the possibility that it's going to turn out that he was deceived, that his wife is not a psula. So until he has had bia rishona, or until four nights have passed, even if he hasn't, up until that point, we assume, the earlier of those two points, we assume that he's really preoccupied and he can't focus, and therefore he's pater from kriya shma, I presume at night. But v'kara laila harishona. Rabban Gamliel apparently got married, and he did read kriya shma the first night. Amru lo tamida. Didn't you teach us that a chasan is pater from kriyashma? Said, I'm not interested in listening to you. I am not going to forego the mitzvah of Kabbalah sal malchus shamayim, even for one moment. Now, the truth is, it's not that it's usur per se to read kriyashma. It's just that the chachamim made a calculation that for most people it's too difficult, so they issued a blanket patur. Rabban Gamliel apparently felt that he was capable of focusing on Kriya Shema when he was going to do the mitzvah Kriya Shema, and therefore he chose to do that. The Gemara will talk about this question because it runs into the discussion of what's known as mechsi kiyuhara. Are you allowed to do things when you're potter, or do things in a way that makes you, that gives an impression of something that you are spiritually on a higher plane than maybe most people would think you are? You know, whenever a person, we might say there are certain places in halacha we say that for a person to adopt a certain kind of chumrah is a mechsi kiyuhara. You look like you're a bal gaiva because you're suggesting I'm such a firm person, I'm such a tzaddik. I this is a chumrah that's worthy for me. I am reminded of one of those beautiful stories that they tell about Rav Amital as a chronal lebracha, the late Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivat Haratzion. Rav Mital apparently said that when he was a bachur in yeshiva and he learned the Mishnah Berurah, so the Mishnah Berurah very often says bal nefesh yachmir le'atzmo. Bal nefesh means, you know, a real medakte. So Rav Mital said that when I was a bachur in yeshiva, when we read bal nefesh yachmir le'atzmo, he said, well, that's not me. I'm not a bal nefesh. Okay, so I don't have to do this. Today, every yeshiva bachur, first day in yeshiva, he reads the Mishnah Berurah, says bal nefesh yachmir le'atzmo. He says, oh, I'm a bal nefesh. So no, most people are not bal nefesh. So mechsi kiyuhara is an important topic. The Gemara will talk about it a little bit, about consistency within Rabban Gamliel's position.
Rabbi Weider?
Yes.
He's potter, not usher. I mean, he's allowed to, that usher to do.
Correct. I said that. I think I said that very explicitly. The Mishnah just says you're exempt. It doesn't say it's usher. The Gemara, however, is going to challenge it on the grounds of mechsi kiyuhara. It will raise it in that discussion. Okay. Tana Rabbanan. The Gemara begins. Ha'umanim korim berosha ilan verosha nidbach. That's what it says in the Mishnah. Umispalalim berosha zayis uberosha te'ena. And if they are on top of an olive tree or on top of a fig tree, then they can daven there as well. Ushar kala ilanos yordin lamata umispalalim. All other trees, they have to go down, they have to descend to the ground in order to daven. So a couple of points about this version of the Braisa. Firstly, just from the get-go, the Braisa is not presumably arguing with the Mishnah, but it's qualifying the Mishnah. The Mishnah said that umanim have to daven, can't daven berosha ilan. The Braisa is saying it depends which kind of tree. Generally, that's true, but there are two trees where they're allowed to daven on top of the tree. We have to talk about why, but I want to talk about one other point as well. I believe we saw in the first parak, I believe that's where does Tosis quote from? Yes. That a person is not allowed to be omeid al makom gavoa and to be mispalo. You're not allowed to stand on top of a high place and daven because it's mimamakim krasicha Hashem. So the question is, putting aside whatever reason you would have, kavana, for people to descend from the tree, but that wouldn't be relevant by a fig tree and an olive tree, why are you allowed to daven on top of the tree from the vantage point of Lo yamar adam bimakom gvoa v'yispalo? A person's not allowed to stand on a high place. So Tosos suggests, and other Rishonim quote this Tosos, that only means when you're in a place, you're in a room, and you stand up on a chair, or you stand up on a table. That's a makom gavoa. But in my house, so I'm currently in the basement. So would you say that if I daven on the main floor, that would be mispalo b'makom gavoa, because my basement's, 9-10 feet lower than my main floor? So the answer is, of course not. Tosus gives the analogy of an aliyah. In other words, if you have a room, you have a place, in that place, you're supposed to be low within the place. When you have a separate story, then it's not an issue. So that's what he says, on top of a tree, from the vantage point of lo yamon adam b'makom gavoa v'yispalel, on top of a tree is always would be considered another makom. Most trees you have to go down for a different reason, because of kavana. Now, the question now is, though, why is it that that on top of a zayis and a te'ena, the worker is allowed to stay up there? So there are two or three interpretations here in the Rishonim. Rashi says that a zayis and a te'ena have such broad branches, enough branches that you can stand there and you're not going to be afraid of falling. I don't know whether this is true or not. To be perfectly honest, I'm willing to bet that Rashi never saw a fig tree or an olive tree living in northern France. I've probably seen a fig tree and olive tree. I certainly have, but I can't really tell you enough about them to argue or agree with Rashi whether or not they're thick enough branches that you're very comfortable standing up there. It's not, Zella, you don't think so.
They're flimsy. They're not.
Yeah. So I don't know. But the other Rishonim have a different interpretation based upon the Yerushalmi. It's not clear what exactly the Yerushalmi, it's not explicit as to what the Yerushalmi means. But for example, the Rush quotes the Yerushalmi here. And I think the Rif quotes this as well. Which says, why Barosh HaZayis Barosh HaTena? So they quote two Amoraim who say, Mitnesha Tircha So Meruba. The Tircha involved is great. So what most Rishonim, I think, understand is that getting up and getting down and out of these trees is very, very difficult. I'm not sure exactly why. Maybe the branches are close together. You have to go very slowly or something. And therefore, they did not want to be Matriach, the workers, once they've gone up in these two trees, even for tefillah, to come down to the ground. Other trees, there's not as much effort involved, so it's not going to. In effect, it's not taking away as much from the Baal HaBayis, and therefore they want the pole to come down for tefillah. But here, really, there's a lot of effort involved, and therefore they opted to say that the workers and the zayis and the te'ina are allowed to daven on top of the tree. The next line in the Braisa says, "Ubaal HaBayis bein kach uvein kach here in the matam asfalo." The Baal HaBayis, he has to come down no matter from what tree he's up in. He has to come down because his data was not Yushevas. His focus is not there because it's a little insecure being up in the trees. So what about the workers? So the answer is, Kavana is obviously a spectrum. So we weigh the value of having as much Kavana as possible as against the costs of achieving that Kavana. So the assumption is that by a Baal HaBayis, he works on his own clock. He doesn't work for anybody. It's not theft for him to take a few minutes off. So the Baal HaBayis, we demand that he come down and strive for greater kavana. Whereas the Poalim are working on someone else's dime. And therefore, if it's easy to come down, so we feel that's not enough of an imposition upon the Baal HaBayis' time to tell them that they should sacrifice the kavana. But once it's difficult to come down, it's time consuming. So then we allow them to daven the Rosh HaZayis of Rosh HaTe'ena. Okay, so now now I mentioned before, these types of issues are relevant, Kriya Shema and Tefillah, during, when you daven at home, because when you're in shul generally, unless you pull out your phone, which generally is not appropriate, you don't really have too many distractions. You can daydream, that we're all very good at, and think about other things, but you don't have real distractions in front of you. But when you're sitting in your own home, you have everything going on in front of you, so it's tempting to do X, Y, and Z. So this particular...
Maybe you could say that the Baal HaBayis hasn't got too much expertise in that tree. He might fall out. There'll be sakana, as opposed to the worker, as opposed who is crafty in doing both.
So it's you could argue that, Although you wonder what the Balabais would be doing up in three in the first place if he's not so, and if he's got workers. But okay, Rashi says that his fear, it's his fear of falling. And even though we're lenient by the workers because of Bitul Malacha, they weren't making by the Balabais. That's how Rashi explains. Okay, so now the Gemara says, Tanan, the Mishnah teaches, Ha'umanim Korim Berosh Ha'ilan of Rosh Ha'Nidbach. That's our Mishnah. Alma lo boy kavana. You see that Kriyashma doesn't require kavana because we don't make the pollen come down. Virimin and viriminhi hakore shema sarach shiachavenes libo shenemar shema Yisrael. The pasuk obviously is shema ulahalan hu omer haskes ushma Yisrael. Haskes means pay careful attention and listen. So ma lahalan bahaskes afkan bahaskes. So that was what he asked Rava. How is it that we say Kriya Shema requires kavana, but we don't make the workers, we don't make them come down? So Ishtik, Rava didn't have an answer. So Amar Lei, Rava then says to Rav Mari Berei de Bas Shmuel, he says, Midi Shmuel Chabaha, have you heard anything about this? You ask the question. Sometimes you ask a question because you don't know the answer. Sometimes you ask a question because you want to see if somebody has an answer. Maybe you have your own answer. Maybe you heard a different answer. So in this case, apparently he had heard Rav Sheshes say something. Amar le hachi amar Rav Sheshes v'hu shebetelim imalachtam v'korim. Yeah, the umanim, the workers do not need to come down from on top of the tree to say Kriya Shema, but they have to stop working. In other words, they're busy working on the tree. Now comes Man Kriya Shema, stop work, stay there, reach Shema, then you go back to work. So that's how Rav Sheshes, as presented by Rav Mari Brei de Bas Shmuel, Shmuel's granddaughter, Rashi points out, and other Rishonim note, Rav Mari Brei de Bas Shmuel, they don't mention his father because he didn't have a Jewish father. His mother had been taken captive, and then one of the captors fell in love with her, but had impregnated already, but he converted. His name was Isser Giura, Isser the Ger. But because technically he wasn't halachically Rav Mari's father, so he's usually quoted as Rav Mari Brei de Bas Shmuel. He was the son of Shmuel's daughter. So he had heard from Rav Sheshes that the Mishnah says you don't have to come down, but the Brice is with you telling you that you have to stop doing work. So now the Gemara says, is that really true? V'hatanya. You're allowed to continue working while you read Kriya Shema. So you see, you don't have to stop. So the Gemara answers, and I say that I choose my words very carefully. Lokasha, the Gemara answers, Habet Perek Rishon, Habet Perek Sheni. It depends where. Perek Rishon means the first Parsha Shema. Perek Sheni means the second Parsha Shema. So Shema and V'yahavta, till the end of the Parsha, require stopping from work. Once you get to Vayim Shemama, you can go back to answering your emails or whatever it is. I don't advise doing that, by the way, but at least the Paulim are allowed to answer their emails if that's your job. So that's where the Gemara leaves this. Now, what's very interesting about this, and the Rishonim noted this, the Rif is the first one probably to mention. What is this about? Why is it that you're not allowed to continue working while you're reading Kriya Shema? So I would have said, and Tosfos assumes this way, as does the Baal Hamor, that it's because of Kavana. Because when you're doing other work, you can't focus. You can't have the same kind of Kavana. But if that's the case, then the Gemara's distinction is wrong. Because we paskin that only the first pasuk requires Kavana. And in fact, Rava is the one who said that earlier. First it was Rav, quoting I think Rabbi Meir, and Rava, who say that pasuk Rishon is sufficient. So if that's the case, why does the Gemara here say Perek Rishon versus Perek Sheni? Even more to the point, who gave this teretz? Well, remember, Rav Mari Brei de Bas Shmuel asked Rava a question. Rava didn't know the initial answer. Rav Mari Brei de Bas Shmuel presented an answer in the name of Rav Sheshes. And then somebody anonymously challenged it from the Brice of Beis Hillel, who says Oskim Alachta Mekorim. And then someone says, Lokasha Haba Perek Rishon Haba Perek Sheni. Now, who challenged it, who answered it? If that is Rava's involvement, then it would strengthen the question even more, because Rava's the one who said a daf or two earlier, only the first part requires a kavana. Whereas here, Rava says, the whole Perek Rishon, you have to stop doing work. So Tosus here, very briefly, the third Tosus in the bottom of the page, Habib Perek Rishon says, Lav Davka Nakat Perek Rishon. The Hainu Aliba the Rava, the Rava Amar Le'el Pasuk Rishon Levad. The Tosus says it's only the first Pasuk. Bahachi Hilchasa. That Tosus, all you need is Kavanah first Pasuk. If you're stopping doing your work in order to read Shema, you only have to stop for the first Pasuk. The Rif here doesn't agree. The Rif says that this actually, the fact that the Gemara says Perek Rishon, and some of the Rishonim say, they try to prove from the fact that it's Rava here, even though it's not explicitly Rava, the fact that Rava earlier says only first, the first Pasuk requires intent, Kavanah, and yet here Rava seems to say Perek Rishon, you have to stop doing your work. So the Rif says it's not about Kavanah. It's about not making Kriya Shema Arai. V'shinantam levanecha v'dibarta bam shelo yehei Ikar diburcha elabam. Your primary dibur is supposed to be in Dibrei Torah, in this case, Shema. So to read the first parsha of Shema, yes, you don't need kavana after the first pasuk, but to be doing other things while you're reading the first parsha of Kriya Shema makes it look like the parsha Kriya Shema is arai, and really the ikar is whatever else you're doing. And therefore, the Rif says that even though we paskin, only the first pasuk requires kavana, you have to stop doing what you're doing, at least during Perek Rishon. Okay. So now, the Gemara says the following. Tanu Rabbanan, ha-po'alim shayu osim melacha eitza bal habayis, korin kriya shma, u'mevarchin lefaneh lachareha. If you are working for a bal habayis all day, so the time of kriya shma comes in the middle of your work day. So you're allowed to read kriya shma, make brachos before and after Kriya Shema. The Ochlim Pitan, you're allowed a lunch break. Umevarchin lefaneh ulacharah. And you make hamotzi and you bench afterwards, even though it takes time. And umispalel and tefillah shel shmon esrei. You daven a full shmon esrei. Aval ein yordin lefnei hateva. You don't have a shliach tzibur get up and daven. You don't make a minyan. Ve'ein nosin kapem. And you don't have nesias kapayim. It might be, by the way, that if you have a minyan, everybody davens at the same time. That's called tefillah b'tzibur, but there's no chazar sashatz and there's no birchas kohanim because that is not necessary and that's stealing from the time of the bal habayis. So now the Gemara says, v'hatanya, we have a different brisa which taught the same halacha about what a poel does and doesn't do, but instead of saying mispalel tefillah shel shmona esrei, it said me'ein yurches. You only say tefillas havineinu, something that we haven't yet explored. It's going to come up really in the fourth parak because we're still doing Kriya Shema. Havineinu is the first three brachos normal, the last three brachos normal, and then a very condensed version of all of the middle 12 or 13 brachos, however you want to count it. It ends with Baruch Ata Hashem Shomea Tfila. Havineinu is really, really, really fast compared to a full Shemon Esrei. I mean, probably for most of us, it saves about 2 or 3 minutes, but it's certainly a lot shorter proportionally. So the Gemara says, we have a brisa that tells you that the poalim are not supposed to stay a full shmona esrei, but rather they say me'ein yurches tfilas havineinu. So Amar Rav Sheshes lokasha haraban gamliel harabi Yoshua. There is a machlokes later in the fifth parak, I believe, fourth or fifth parak. What shmona esrei are you normally supposed to say on a regular day? Mechuyev to say. Rabban Gamliel says that you normally have to say yurches brachos on the normal circumstances. You have to say a full shmona esrei. Rabbi Yeshua says, no, Rabbi Yeshua says, you're absolutely mutter to say Havineinu. You can say the short Shemon Esrei if you want. So the suggestion here was that these two opinions, whether the Paul says a full Shemon Esrei or the Paul says Havineinu, a Me'in Shemon Esrei, a condensed version, depends upon the Machlokas Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Gamliel says you have to say a full Shemon Esrei. Rabbi Yeshua says you can say Havineinu. So the Gemara asks, wait, E Rabbi Yeshua, my area Poalim, Afilu Kol Adam Nami. According to Rabbi Yeshua, not only are workers allowed to shorten their Shemon Esrei, but everybody's allowed to shorten their Shemon Esrei. So why teach in this context Me'ein Shemon Esrei? Now, before we provide the Gemara's answer, I think it's very important to note again a comment of the Rishonim here. Tosus asked the question, why is the Gemara so surprised that Rabbi Yeshua should feel the need to tell us this? Maybe Rabbi Yeshua means the following. You and I, who are not working on someone else's dime, we're allowed to say Havineinu. But a poel has to say Havineinu. And as if you or I, who are allowed to say Havinayin according to Rabbi Shua, decide, I'm in a better mood today. I'm feeling focused. I'm going to daven a full Shemone Esrei. So of course I can daven a full Shemone Esrei. But a poel is not allowed to, because if he's allowed to daven Havinayin, he's stealing from the Baal HaBayis. So Tosfos asks, why didn't the Gemara answer? No, the reason why Rabbi Yeshua has to tell us that a poel says Havinayin is to tell us that he's mechuyev to say Havinayin, as opposed to everybody else who's merely allowed to say Havinayin. So Tosfos says, the Gemara didn't answer that because it's so obvious. If the poel is allowed to say Havinayin, of course he has to say Havinayin. What would be the Havamin to allow him to take the extra 2-3 minutes from the Baal HaBayis' time once it's permissible for him to say Havinayin? If you want to be machmer, you can't be machmer at somebody else's expense. It has to be at your own expense, not at the expense of your Baal HaBayis, not at the expense of your spouse, not at the expense of your children. Chumras come out of your own dime, nobody else's. So Tosfos says the Gemara didn't even have to think to say, oh, maybe Rabbi Yeshua is telling us in this case, it's a chova for the poelim as opposed to everybody else who it's a reshus, because once it's a reshus for everybody else, it's obviously a chova for the poelim. It was unnecessary. It would have been unnecessary for Rabbi Yeshua to tell us that. So now the Gemara says, lo kasha, ela idi v'idi, Rabban Gamliel. Now, both are Rabban Gamliel, and Rabban Gamliel is talking about workers. Sometimes they say Havinayin, sometimes they say a full Shemone Esrei, right? And he says, v'lo kasha, kan be'osin bischaran, kan be'osin besudasan. It depends whether or not they are working for a wage or whether they're only working for the food that the Baal HaBayis feeds them. Now, I don't know exactly how people survive such an arrangement. If you're only working for the meals that the Baal HaBayis provides you, and I assume he provided his part of them with lunch and dinner, not just lunch. So I don't know how else they provided for their other needs. I mean, it's true, they would be fed. They wouldn't go hungry, but they wouldn't have shelter, clothing, and so on. So I don't really understand. Maybe it was an itinerant, maybe it was somebody who was just looking to travel to see the country. So he needed to do work sometimes to eat. So some days he would eat and he would work for his food. And otherwise, I don't know what he would do the other days. But bottom line is that when you're only being fed by the Baal HaBayis, we have lower expectations for you. You're allowed to say a full Shemone Esrei. We're going to see that you say a longer benching as well. Whereas when the Baal HaBayis is paying you and he's feeding you, but probably primary point is that he's paying you, then you have to be much, when he's paying you by the hour, you have to be much more makpid. When you're just working for your food, maybe he's paying you by the day and there's an assumption that you, certain things you have to do out of this day. So now the Gemara says, as proof to this, that there's a distinction between whether or not you're working for wages versus just working for your meals. V'hatanya, now this V'hatanya, I learned this from Rabbi Dulitz, a Shlita, many, many, many years ago, that the word V'hatanya means one of two things. It's either V'hatanya, it's a question, but we taught. And the other possibility, much, much more rarely, V'hatanya is, and so we taught. Because the latter is so, proportionally speaking, rare, whenever the Gemara has a V'hatanya, which is a proof as opposed to a question, Rashi always writes this one word. And if you look, Rashi says it here, V'hatanya b'nichusa. B'nichusa as opposed to b'tmiha. B'tmiha means a question. B'nichusa means, I guess, not a question. It means gently or something. So the Gemara says it's proof of this distinction between workers who work for wages as opposed to who work just for their meals. V'hatanya ha'polim shayu osa malacha itza Baal HaBayis. Koren kriyashma umispalalin, v'ochlim piton. But ain't, according to Rashi's girsa, ain't mevarchim lefanel, you don't even make hamotzi because it's only the rabbanon, and you don't want to waste the time. Many rishonim have the girsa, don't have this in their girsa. The Ritva says, yeah, it's true, hamotzi is only the rabbanon, the bracha before, but how much time does it take you to say hamotzi? 5 seconds? And then avo mevarchim lachareha, you certainly bench afterwards because birchas hamasin is the raisa. Shtayim, but you only make 2 brachos in your Berachas HaMazon. Ketzad, bracha rishona kitikuna, the first bracha, azanas hakol, is normal. And then, pshniya, the second bracha, you condense. Poseach beberachas haaretz, v'kol olam bebona Yushalayim. You merge 2 brachos together. Bebona Yushalayim, what's the girsa here? And v'chosein beberachas haaretz. Probably you have both chasimos together. Something about al ha'aretz v'al ha'mazon v'al Yerushalayim, or something like that. You condense these 2 brachos of Birchas HaMazon into one. And obviously, you don't even say Atov HaMetim. So, and now the Braisa says, v'ametzer v'amurin, v'osim b'scharam, when you pull in hourly wage, av'al osim b'sudasan, if it's just your meals, o'shea b'al ha'bayis meisiv mar, the b'al ha'bayis is eating with them, Then Derech Eretz dictates on the latter, Mevarachin Kitikuna. You make a regular Birchas Hamazon. So basically, the Gemara says there's fundamentally a distinction between how a worker is being paid. And when he's Oseh B'Scharon, when he's really being paid, presumably he may be by the day, but he's being paid for his time in a full sense, then he's got to be much, much more careful with the Balabais' time. And we are, in fact, much more sensitive to that, reducing his obligations. And there's a very interesting question that is asked here by some of the Rishonim. Tosfos, at the bottom, Tosfos on our page. Tosfos, when it says, V'chosei mebirkas aretz, Tosfos says, Afal gad demidaraisahem. Tosfos says, how can they condense the two brachos into one? Midaraisa, you require three brachos. Yesh koach biad chachamim lachor davar min haTorah ho utrudim b'melachas balabayis. Now, Tosfos here is both incredible mussar, and it's also a head-scratcher. The incredible mussar, Tosfos says, is that this is a violation of Torah law. You're being mevatel mitzvah. Tosfos assumes that you need all three brachos, and by taking two of the brachos and condensing them into one, you're uprooting fulfillment of a Torah mitzvah. And nonetheless, because they are doing the balabayis' melacha, the chachamim abrogated the din daraisa here, which is rather astounding. What's a head-scratcher about Tosfos is a question asked by the Beis Yosef. And I asked this question, which means it was probably so obvious that the Beis Yosef beat me to it. The Beis Yosef says, what's Tosfos talking about? The themes are daraisa. In your Birchas HaMazon, you have to thank God for the food, for the land, and for Binyan Yerushalayim. The idea that you have to have three separate brachos, says who? Who says that you need a matbea midoraisa? Midoraisa of three separate brachos. Midrabanan, I understand. It's not enough to capture all the themes of Birchas HaMazon that the halacha demands, but you also have to have it as three brachos. And in fact, I would note that there are those who say that the bracha of brachos me'in sheba might be deoraisa, the al hamichya might be deoraisa, because if you look at al hamichya, and it might be mekayim birchas hamazon deoraisa, because if you look at al hamichya, it's al hamichya, and you mention an eretz chandatova, and then you have bona yushalayim in it. So all three themes of birchas hamazon, and you have tatova meitiv at the end. All the themes of Birchas HaMazon are condensed into Bracha Achas Mein Shalosh. And that might be a Kiyum Daraisa, is only one Bracha on it. So it is, so Tosis's question, one could challenge the premise of the question, but the statement is a phenomenally staggering statement by Tosos. How much the Chachamim were Makbid on that the Poalim not be Gozel from the Balabayas. I should add as a very important caveat, I have harped very much this morning on the Poalim's obligation to the Baal HaBayis. It's not because the obligations of workers to the employer are greater than that of the employer to the workers. It's just that that happens to be what our Gemara is focused on. If we were studying Perek HaSocher in Bava Metzia, so then we would mostly be talking about what are the Baal HaBayis' obligations to the Poalim. But both are very, very clearly delineated, and both are regarded as extremely important on both parties. Okay, any questions?
Strengthening your interpretation of Tosfos and the astonishing chumrah concerning the workers, and the fact that the chachamim were oker a doraisa in order to protect the rights of the owner. The cancellation of the bracha rishona is also extraordinary, and it's not even Tosfos. I mean, it's right there.
Right.
On the one hand, on the other hand, as I thought about the bracha rishona, obviously, when they made the bracha rishona, they didn't just say bracha rishona. They said it the way I heard the Bayana Rebbe when he made Havdalah. I heard him make Havdalah once, and he said it this way: "Burich ato ad Hashem Elokeini Melech Ha'olam Boire Pri Hagufe," and I just thought. He continued that way in Havdalah, that in my life, I never made Havdalah. And in my future life, I'm never going to make Kabbalah. It was just mind-blowing to see the Kavana that he made. So without them all being the Bayana Rebbe, apparently their Bracha Rishona was a little better than our mumbling Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz.
Yes, I think that's a very, very good point. Yes. Any other questions?
Where, Rabbi, where is, you said that the Baal HaTur said this about, had a comment on this. Where is it? Is in the, it's in Arba Turin?
Which comment?
The last thing you were talking about.
The Beis Yosef, you mean? Yeah, that's that.
Oh, not the Baal HaTur, the Beis Yosef.
Beis Yosef is on this in Aruch Chaim. If you take a look at if you want the exact source, the Karban Nisanel on the Rush, the Madana Yom Tov on the Rush actually quotes this. I'll tell you very quickly. I think Simen Kuf Tzadi Aleph, 191. Okay. Any other questions?
If we are supposed to be davening Imam Akim, why does a shul, most bimas have a platform?
So I think our assumption. I think that's probably relatively new, and a lot of shuls, you know, the bima was where they read the Torah from, not where the chaz and daven from. I think we only have the chaz and daven there from. You know, the truth is the shul. I don't know how they worked it out. Oh no, I think I do know how they worked it out. But the I think shuls only have the chaz and daven from the bima because of acoustics. But the truth is, I grew up in a shul where the chazan shachar daven from the amud, you know, which was in front of the aron, but on the ground. The aron was, you know, on a stage, but the amud in front of it was on the ground, and you daven shachar there. And musaf, you started your kumporka on, you know, on the bima, but after you took the Torah back, you came and you davened, I believe, from the amud in front. You still have a trace of this in the shul I daven in on Shabbos. They daven shachar musaf, but Kabbalah Shabbos, we start on the bima, but once we start Baruch Hu, you actually you go to the Amud. So, if not for the issues of decorum, it probably is more appropriate, technically speaking, because the area of the bima is probably more than Dalet al Dalet Amos, and it's got walls around it. It is like an aliyah, so it is like a separate makom.
Rabbi Weider?
Yes.
The condensation of the brachos. Why would the Poalim would have to be a bit of a scholar to sort of understand how to condense the brachos? Wouldn't it have been easier to tell them to say Al HaMichya, which you mentioned has all the themes?
Firstly, not everybody, now I'm going to take the other side. Not everybody agrees that Al HaMichya is a key. Well, it's hard to imagine why it wouldn't be a key of the Raisa, but I guess they did not want to totally, they didn't want to compromise on everything. I would also add that, it's very possible that someone was leading the benching. In other words, when you have a mezuman, only the mezamein says, we don't do this anymore. but the proper way of doing zimun, and I'm not advising anyone to do that, because the Rishonim already say, we don't pay careful attention. The Rush says this. But ideal zimun is that the mezamein that leads the zimun, we respond, he says the entire Birchas HaMazon out loud, we say nothing. Because Birchas HaZimun, when you have a mezuman, it's really one person making the bracha for everybody. It's not Shomei Ka'ona. He's making the bracha for everybody. We avoid doing that because people will not always pay attention. But in principle, it probably would have been one person who led for them. So that probably doesn't matter.
Thank you.
Okay.